The second case is called versus Eduardo Perez. Who will be arguing on behalf of the people?
Kevin McReynolds on behalf of the people, Your Honor.
Mr. McReynolds, thank you. And for the defendant, please?
Andrew Hare.
Mr. Hare, thank you. All right, we're ready to go. Each side has 30 minutes. You'll be able to tell your time from the podium. So, Mr. McReynolds.
Good morning, may it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado Law Number 40978, on behalf of the Commission. The primary issue in this case is one of legislative intent. What did the General Assembly intend to prohibit when it created Colorado's identity theft statute in 2006? And what they intended to criminalize here was conduct that hurts real Coloradans. The 21st century crime of identity theft, which had not been properly addressed by the statutes that existed at that time, and which needed to be addressed. Now, in this case, what we had happened was we have a defendant who deliberately assumed the single most unique piece of identifying information, the single most unique form of identifying information that people in this country have, which is a person's social security number. And that was the crime they intended to prohibit when they passed 18592. It depends on the existence of a victim. The prosecution must prove that a real person did in fact have their information used. And that is what distinguished it from previously existing statutes. Now, there are five different sources which help show us that this was in fact the legislative intent when they passed 18592. The first is the statutory scheme. Before the identity theft statute was passed in 2006, Colorado did have a much lower first crime, a felony six called criminal impersonation, which was a different piece of 18585113. And that prohibited the assumption of a false or fictitious identity. Now, that had been interpreted and applied to instances where somebody had claimed to be somebody they're not. It included completely counterfeit names, made up names. If I said my name is Princess Leia, I would be claiming to have a fictitious identity. Now, when they added this, they were very conscious of the fact that the identity theft statute was going to be covering things in the same area, but differently than the previously existing criminal impersonation statute. And in fact, legislative history shows us that it's specifically contemplated. What we have existing, this criminal impersonation statute, is insufficient. It's not going to be done, and most importantly, they kept over and over recognizing it doesn't recognize the true victim of this crime. The true victim of this crime is the person who's identified. We need a real deterrent that the sponsor discussed. We need a stronger statute and to make sure that we keep these separate, that we understand which when one applies versus the other. They create a special definition. It has a special definition of the term of another. It's in 18591 definitional statutes that pass along with this term. And that of another statute says that it belongs to a real person, internet, or a business entity, as defined by a cross-reference to the part of the law. And that was the key was if a real person's information, if a real person exists here, if there's a real victim, then you're talking about identity. If we're talking about a young person, then it's criminal impersonation. It's a lesser offense, specifically because there's an actual disability.
Can I stop you there? How do you think that this is basically a legislative history kind of argument you're making?
I was referring there next.
Okay. I guess what I was curious about is, since we have a statute that explains how mens rea are to be applied in statutes passed by the legislature. And I think statute indicates that the mens rea will apply to every material element unless a legislative intent otherwise clearly appears.
Yes.
How do you see the relationship between things like legislative history, other definitions, other contexts, and that particular statute?
What that statute is a codification of a rule of construction. It's the sort of a rule that we apply when a statute is ambiguous. We can't tell from the plain language whether it only applies to just the conduct here or if it applies to other things. So we have a codified statutory presumption. It is not a, it is a presumption. It's rebuttable. It can be rebutted by all of these other sources. And in fact, I think the Cross case is sort of constructive about this point, because in that case, they were dealing with using that same codified rule of construction, 18.1.5.034. And how they recognized that this is a presumption, but we have to look at the legislative intent. And we're not moving to the text of the rule itself. In Cross, they look to a legislative declaration, which is one of the list of items that the legislature says we need to look to when we've got to look at the statute, specifically on this. 2.4.203G is the legislative declaration. That's something that the legislature directs us to look at when we've got to look at the statute. Other things that are on that list, like legislative purpose, circumstances, and enactment, legislative history, related laws, like criminal personation, the consequences of the construction. Those are all also on those lists, and those are all also sources we need to look to in applying that codified presumption in 18.1.503 in determining whether that presumption carries the day or whether, in fact, we can clearly see the legislative intent otherwise. That includes the legislative history that Dr. Gibbons gets a little bit deeper. Because in addition to statutory scheme, how it all fits together, where we have this harmonized structure, we also have for three related items, the circumstances of when this kind of statute was enacted, the legislative history, and the purpose of the statute. And as we discussed rather early in the briefs, and I'll just reiterate a couple points here, is that the legislative history, the sponsors were discussing this new statute, and they were differentiating it from criminal impersonation based on the existence of real victims. And in fact, one of those real victims who testified at minute 21 of the House Judiciary 2006 legislative history talked about how he'd done everything in his power to protect himself from having his identity stolen, but he'd still ended up being a victim. He'd still had somebody else use his social security number and get a bill for what he was following him. He didn't know if his case had been used for work purposes and was going to have to deal with the IRS. Now, the reason I think that particular victim's testimony is particularly important is that under the construction below, under the defendant's proposed construction, that person is not protected by this law. He was testifying on behalf of the sponsors in support of this law. Specifically, I'm a victim and we need this law to protect people like me. And with 52 co-sponsors and no dissent for amendment to that term, this law passed. But if the parents or the court appeals interpretation below is correct, that the law not only requires that they knowingly uses this information, but that they have to specifically know that it belonged to a real person, that person isn't protected. Is unprotected because he didn't even have this information after he was taken. And if you look at the text of the statute, specifically the 1A section that was interpreted below, it's not about use and obtained information. It's use. It's whether or not a person knows when you personally identify or negotiate. That's the conduct that we're trying to prohibit here.
Mr. McReynolds, can I back you up a minute? I want to take you back to the statute Justice Coates asked you about, 18.1.503.4. As I understand your argument about the general legislative history here, that statute says that when the statute defines an offense, prescribes an element thereof, the mental state is deemed to apply to every element unless an attempt to limit the application clearly applies. I think the legislative history you should be, need to be addressing here is what legislative history tells us that knowingly was not supposed to apply to another person. I mean, I get the general legislative history and the purpose, but I think the statute requires you to show us where the legislature said knowingly does not apply to another person.
I think that that is one source, and I think that the fact that they are distinguishing the statutes based on the existence is in fact showing that their legislative intent was that that was to be the distinction, and I think it's notable that they did not say. And also, we're criminal impersonation still applies to everybody who is using of another, who is using real people and people's information, unless they specifically know it wasn't real person's information. I recognize that this is a presumption. However, this is but one of several sources, the legislative history being one of several sources showing that the intent was in fact to protect Coloradans from having their information that was discussed during the history specifically. Our purpose here is to protect Coloradans.
I'm sorry. Council, I'm sorry if I could pick up right there on this point, because I guess I'm still struggling with, I recognize that the addition of this phrase, another, was intended to protect real people with real information. It seems to still beg the question, though, of whether knowingly applies to that new element that has been added. And I guess I wanted to toss out to you, I looked at for the ordinary theft provision in Title 18, and that statutory provision likewise refers to exercise of control or other verbs that pertain to a property of another. And it seems to me that in the concept, just basic concept of theft, I'm stealing something that I know belongs to someone else. I mean, would you suggest that of another in the context of ordinary theft would not require the defendant to know that they were taking property that belonged to someone else?
I would have to address the difficulty, Your Honor, which is that there is not a special definition of another or of another person in the standard theft, or I think another one that was discussed with the criminal mischief statute. And that's because when we're dealing with tangible real items, they do belong to somebody. They do act. Here, we're in a sort of special context where identity theft versus criminal impersonation, we're dealing with personally identifying information that may or may not belong to anyone. If I gave out a social security number that starts 000, that is in fact a completely invalid social security number that doesn't belong to anyone. That's an important distinction here, because we can have somebody using personally identifying information that is another person, or we can have somebody using personally identifying information that's counterfeit that doesn't belong to anyone.
Right, and the statute imposes greater punishment in a situation where that information does belong to a real person.
Yes.
And yet you seem to say that it does so irrespective of the defendant's culpability.
Yes.
Whether the defendant knows or doesn't know. Is that, I'm worried that creates some constitutional problems if we're facing greater punishment without some sort of corresponding increased culpability on behalf of the defendant.
It's not a constitutional issue, my opinion. We have something that has already very significant culpability requirements. They must knowingly use the person to get this information. They must do so with the purpose of using it for the owner of the cat to, with the intent to obtain the cash, credit, or any other thing. This circumstance is really no different than like an age circumstance. Or, again, for example, we had an objective standard of whether or not this about was caused. We have an objective standard here for whether or not this circumstance existed. And that was what the legislature intended. This was not the the criminal impersonation sentence enhancement act. They were not looking to take particularly specially culpable offenders and put them in one group and make this statute all but nullity in the majority of its applications.
Well, let's get back to, I think, the essence of Justice Marquez's question is, isn't it just by happenstance whether this fake identification belongs to a real person or not a real person? I mean, you could get some fake ID that, you know, on its face seems sort of bogus, like belonged to Snow White or something, but there might really be somebody named Snow White. So, you know, is really the difference here whether there is a real Snow White or whether this is a made-up Disney ID?
The reason I believe that it does depend on whether or not this person actually exists or not is because that is the reason that they wanted this statue. They wanted to, as they said.
Sure, I understand that's what they wanted, but right. How does that get us into what's in the defendant's head when he commits this crime? Because by happenstance, he could be liable for a much greater crime than what he thought. He thought, oh, I'll take this bogus Snow White ID. That'll be fine. You know, I can do whatever I want with it. But then it turns out there's a real Snow White.
Yes, sir. And the point here is sort of where did the legislature intend the risk to lie? Did they want the victim to be one who bore the risk of not being the recognized victim, not being the party who was in fact harmed? Because the harm is the same. Whether or not I know that this Social Security number within Colorado Regents belongs to a specific person here in Colorado or not, that the harms that person suffers are the same. That is why there's an extension here. What we have is somebody who is deliberately assuming an identity they know isn't their own, that they know that they're doing so with the intent of gaining credit. If somebody were to, for example, use my name and to go buy a car, using my credit and my Social Security number, whether they believe Kevin McReynolds with my Social Security number exists or not is irrelevant to the harm that I'm going to suffer. And that is the distinction the legislation wanted to get here. The purpose here was to recognize the true victim of the crime here, which was not recognized by the criminal impersonation statute. And that purpose is also that far better fulfilled through the people's interpretation, which does avoid absurd results, like somebody who uses every piece of information in a one-off transaction and can simply claim, I bought off the guy on the street. I can't be prosecuted for identity theft. We have to believe that that was what the legislature intended to narrow identity theft to the point that we're essentially encouraging identity theft rings in secondary markets, which is in fact how identity theft is actually committed.
Mr. McReynolds, can I back you up a little bit and ask you a more basic question? The prosecutor in this case did not object to the jury instruction and stated that he said, I have to prove that Mr. Perez was using a Social Security number that didn't belong to him, that he knew it belonged to another person, and that he did it to obtain cash. How are we here? Did the prosecutor preserve this?
The prosecutor did not preserve this. It is, however, a pure issue of law, which is reviewed over at every level. The Court of Appeals chose to take it up sua sponte and declined to hear the people's position on that. This was not our appeal. The jury was instructed on the defendant's interpretation. The jury heard the evidence, and the jury concluded that he was, in fact, guilty of identity theft.
But that goes to issue two, right? That even if we were to say that the knowingly applies, there was sufficient evidence.
Yes, that is the second point. But as far as your preservation question, I agree with you. It was not preserved, but the concession and the issue of law by the prosecutor is not binding on us. And we're allowed to defend the conviction on any grounds. Here we have a purely novel issue of law. And if the court were to decline to hear that question, we would address the second issue that's before the court here. And of course, the exact same issue is before this court in a parallel case.
Thank you.
Can we shift that?
I'm sorry, Justice.
Go ahead. I was going to move to the second issue. Do you want to stay with the first?
Let me just ask you, so how, I'm sorry, can you explain a little bit better, how did the Court of Appeals end up addressing the issue? What happened at the Court of Appeals?
The defendant raised a sufficiency issue. The people defended that sufficiency issue. When it became clear during oral argument that they were inclined to address the statutory interpretation issue, which had not been agreed by either side, I had attempted to present those arguments. and was told not to do so because it had not been, had not been approved. And that was what happened.
Okay, thank you.
So let me just hear you articulate your argument on the second issue as concisely as possible. Give me your best shot on sufficiency.
So the large problem with the Court of Appeals decision below is rather than looking at the total quantity of evidence that was before the jury and then applying the deferential standard for sufficiency, instead it looked to a series of extrinsic sources to essentially try to disprove reasonable inferences that could be drawn from the evidence. And they ended up with an inaccurate result. For example, they looked to the Forrest Figueroa case and some of the factual predicates that were talked about there, that in between the years 2000 and 2006, the defendant in that other case had used a counterfeit number without getting caught to essentially try to disprove the defendant's repeated use of that same identifying information to get jobs and wages for the payroll systems. Wasn't a reasonable inference to say that its repeated use showed that it was. It was an indication of circumstantial evidence that it was a valid number. And that's inaccurate. It's the 2005 New York Times article that was attached to cancer ratios. The Social Security Administration sends out hundreds of thousands of letters every year to get Social Security deductions for counterfeit numbers. Hey, this doesn't actually know anything to figure out who, you know, was it a number transpose here or was it an issue here? And that sort of, in a way, what we have here is competing inferences. Which inference was better? The Court of Appeals sort of looked to an extrinsic source to pick a side of that and say that it was irrational for the jury to reach the other inference.
So what's the most compelling intrinsic source?
Intrinsically, I think there were sort of two main pieces of evidence. One was the location. I mean, we have a defendant who was arrested in the exact same zip code where the victim lived, which created both an inference of access and a suggestion that he knew was valid, knew it was less likely to question, going back to sort of Social Security Administration's oversight of things. If we have somebody collecting wages in five different locations, that's more likely to be questions, more likely to create questions. Here we have somebody who was just down the road. The concept that this was a random series of nine digits that just happened to work out to an individual down the road, that is frankly kind of absurd. Next we have the testing. We have testimony, sort of the defendants. The defendant used this ID to work at four different locations. The Department of Labor testimony and exhibits that show that not the victim, but but somebody had used it to work at the Famous Dave's Barbecue Workers' Top, as well as at a two different IHOPs and then at the restaurant. And then if you look at his employment application, is the time periods for those uses of the Social Security number all match up with what he claimed his work history was. And that was certainly circumstantial evidence of testing. If one payroll system had rejected it, he would have had reason to believe that it was a counterfeit number, or he had gotten a no-match letter from the Social Security Administration saying, hey, this is a made-up number. Who is this? Who's working for this number? That's what it says. And instead, he basically got an idea that it was a valid number because he could use it for years and not without it being questioned.
Can I ask you a question about the relationship between these two arguments?
Yes.
Do you understand the Court of Appeals to be requiring that you know who the person is?
No, Your Honor. What they're requiring is that you know if the information belongs to a real person.
And so I guess my question is, given your argument about why there's sufficient evidence circumstantially, is the distinction you want us to draw, the fine distinction between knowing, between there being a real person and knowing that this belongs to a real person, is that very meaningful? In effect, aren't you arguing there is sufficient circumstantial evidence as long as you effectively use another number?
Well,
I think there could be a sufficient circumstance where it's here because the number was used repeatedly across the series of systems. That distinction is still very important because it's something that any one-off transaction, regardless of its scale, will in fact not be provable through the types of evidence that we did have here, because we wouldn't have that type of evidence here. If somebody used your name, social security number, to buy a car tomorrow, that they can claim very easily. I bought this ID off the street, and I cannot be prosecuted by identity.
And notwithstanding credit check or whatever, presumably any of those things would require that it turn up some real credit.
It would require the turn of some real credit, but it wouldn't show that it was in fact this person. If it's name and social security number, or if somebody just checks social security number, which may happen in Montes Rodriguez case, it wasn't a match on name, it was just simply a credit check. It was a one-off transaction. It was just using social security number. It did turn up real credit information because it was a real number. But there wouldn't have been the issue, the testing we have here, the knowledge on behalf of the defendant that I used it successfully here. If they then used it someplace else and then someplace else, now we start to have to take evidence, now it starts to be parallel to this case. But if it's a one-off transaction, then there would not be that testing evidence that shows the defendant specifically did it. It was a valid.
And what were the facts of Flores Figueroa? How is what you're describing different from what the U.S. Supreme Court confronted there?
Well, one major difference with Flores Figueroa was we were in fact dealing with the interpretation of a sentence enhancing statute. That is actually a key point because part of why they were making a distinction, which was a context-based distinction, they recognized ordinarily the mens rea applies to all subsequent terms. In this case, the mens rea means to that presumption holds. Because we looked at the context, we looked at legislative history. We looked at what it was the legislature intended, and that enhancement was specifically directed toward those who were engaged in sort of classical identity theft, specifically dumpster diving and so forth. As far as the sufficiency issue,
right.
They were caught. It was caught immediately. He had been using a counterfeit number. He gave his employer a new different number, which did in fact correspond to a person, and then he was arrested for aggravated identity theft. It was not, as we have here, years of repeated use against different cable systems. And because we have so few facts in the Flores Figueroa case, we don't have the extra fact testimony here where we have the manager of the Kansas State Department Congressional case. If we plug in inaccurate and complete information from the W-4 in the payroll system, it won't pay out. Now, she admitted she didn't know anything about the name, about what E-Verify programs where we compare names and social security numbers to make sure it matches. But with high number systems, the dead social security number lists, which are publicly available databases, there can certainly have been programming in that payroll system that in fact would not accept known invalid numbers. There are no further questions. I'd like to reserve last time.
You may do so.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Andrew here on behalf of Eduardo Perez, out of the Public Defender's Office, and my registration number is 16891. As the name implies by the statute we're talking about, identity theft, the statute is seeking to address those who are identity thieves. Just as Marquez mentioned with the theft statute, recently addressed the similarity of the symmetry. Symmetrical nature of those statutes that are worthwhile, at least acknowledging that the name of the statute and what the statute is seeking to address is very similar in nature to the more specified kind of theft. And the name of the statute with respect to statutory construction, something the court needs to assign most to eventually address when it does address this construction or interpretation of the statute. The General Assembly, they're responsible for drafting the laws. Obviously, it is an important area. It's become even more crucial. There was an article in the paper yesterday that then proposed about the transitioning credit cards from the strip to the chip. It's an issue that's ongoing, and it's an important issue in seeking to address identities. One principle of construction is importance. Basically, we'll follow the plain language of the statute. Your Honor, you discussed in light of 18.15.034. Certainly, I think that really is a controlling statutory rule of construction in this case. I intend to kind of go backwards and talk about the plain language of the statute and mention, of course, the URL. Because if the students were to go to an English class and read this sentence, and the English teacher would ask, does knowingly modify up another? Undoubtedly, all the students would raise their hand and say yes. The teacher would say, excellent, dismissed for the day, and good job in your English quiz. And that's just the plain language of the statute. That's the way it's ordinarily interpreted. That's the way it's ordinarily understood. Colorado does have a statute 24111, which acknowledges or says that a court or when anyone is reading our provisions, our code, that common English usage principles apply. So in that context, without being too much 5034, one reading this particular statute, this provision would say, knowingly modifies of another.
Mr. Hare, can I ask you the second part of that quiz for the students? What would be the punctuation if it didn't modify? Would there be different punctuation, do you think? Or how would it be written differently, I guess, if it didn't apply? Tell me the countervailing argument.
It could simply omit the other method or set off of another at some other point in the statute. That is to say, it would not actually follow from the way that the sentence is drafted.
So it would be a different clause.
Perhaps a different clause, correct. Something that's setting it off, something that would bring the departure that the Assistant Attorney General is talking about. But when we read this particular provision in this sentence, the way it naturally flows, there's simply isn't that set off or that departure that would allow for putting on this wall between knowingly and of another. The other of another language, the definition, it includes live persons, dead persons, and businesses, and that was important because obviously each of those three areas are can be subject to identity theft, whether it's an estate or it's a business. And just using the term story, who was one of the sponsors of the bill, explain that this is an important consideration, but it's a little bit different than, say, a typical theft and the theft of another and involving a natural person rather than potentially a dead person or a business. Just making that clear, because that was important to the sponsor of the bill.
Thank you.
Forestry Row was mentioned below at the trial level. Probably, widely 18.5034, probably is essentially unnecessary. It's interesting that the U.S. Supreme Court addressed the statute, which is very similar to ours. Federal statutes don't provide equivalent statute of 18.5034. So that's why it's instructive, at least with respect to court's interpretation of similar language and how the mens rea knowingly applies to of another. In the end, though, 18.15034 controls. Disagree with the Attorney General with respect to its application under ambiguous situations. There's no such understanding of this particular statute. It applies across the board when knowingly or is a mens rea is set out in a particular statute, then it is to apply unless there's some exception clearly against in the legislation.
Counsel, though, from your perspective, it doesn't matter which route we go, correct? I mean, you say you went on plain language and that the statute just happens to codify a plain language reading. Is that correct?
I think it's simply, it's worthwhile to notice and at least acknowledge that this particular statute, provision 81.334, while it's a statute, it's the legislature's intent to work, that their creation or the drafting of the statute is not so crazy that you would apply one to another that it wouldn't otherwise apply to the statute for the present. It simply is that, in this particular case, the two happen to come together and they work together and supportive of the interpretation that Mr. Fritz asked.
Thank you.
It's worth mentioning that the scenario that Mr. Perez found himself in briefly, he applied for a job. He represented himself to use himself at Perez. He used his phone number, he gave his address, he presented his social security card with his name on it and 9 numbers. Now, the Montes Rodriguez situation, which was application for a loan, which is presented a loan application for a social security number, they're very similar in nature. Like a person is seeking to use a social security number to do an analysis of loan credit. In this instance, Mr. Perez had asked him to use a social security card with 9 numbers in order to get employed. That's the nature of retail services. It's the nature of getting a job. The use of the number is essential to placing an application and being considered for employment. That's what he did. But this particular scenario is more now covered by the amendment to the criminal impersonation statute, which cross-references the identity theft statute in the sense that it says that a fictitious identity will be assumed or presumed if you use the identifying information of another without respect to whether you know it, as in this case he doesn't know who it belongs to anybody. But if he uses it, it's not presumed in the criminal impersonation process. And that makes sense because he's less culpable. He doesn't know that it belongs to somebody else. And so this particular provision in cross-references to the defect statute is important because now it covers or arguably covers the scenario that we're dealing with today.
Mr. Hare, may I ask you to address the sufficiency argument that Mr. McReynolds made? I'll confess to you that's where I'm struggling the most in this case. We, of course, have to give the prosecution all the benefit of the doubt here. So if you would address that Mr. Perez used the identification to work in 4 locations over a lengthy period of time, the same zip code, seems coincidental. Again, I'm struggling. If we have to give the prosecution all the benefit of the doubt, why isn't that evidence sufficient?
Sure. Well, at the time that Mr. Perez applied, he presented a social security card number. The person who took that application did not testify on trial. His verdict simply was an employee, assistant manager, in his days, did not take the application, did not immediately recognize the number that has belonged or had been submitted by Mr. Perez. The business about the application being completely accurate, yes, the information had to be completely accurate in the sense that the lines have been filled in across every step with respect to the validity or invalidity of the number that this person testified. They don't check that. They didn't check that. They don't have a protocol. They don't have to. That's why these businesses, they don't have to check it. It's like a safe harbor. There's no need to do it. That's how they obtain employment labor force, as they don't have no need to check whatsoever, no exception. With respect to location, and the notion that because this number belonged to what is represented to be a local resident, first of all, there's no evidence of that in the record. There's no evidence of that presented at trial. This is an interesting observation by the assistant attorney general, but there's no evidence of it in this particular trial. Secondly, it works against the state because if this number is a number that apparently both employers and people would know to belong to a local resident, in Washington, and Margaret Perez, he's representing himself with this particular social security card and number. Well, that's interesting. This number belongs to a local resident, and you're not one of those people. So it would immediately raise a red flag, suspicion, et cetera. The notion of repetition, it cuts both ways. In fact, it's more likely than not that if someone uses a number and it doesn't raise suspicion, it doesn't belong to anyone. No one's raising any. There's no evidence that any of those particular prior employments that an employee or the employer, said, you're not going to work here, that's not
Mr. Hare, can I stop you there? And I'm kind of in the same area as Justice Gabriel. You're kind of making a closing argument why we should not consider that as weight. But when we have to draw inferences the other way, can you address that?
Sure. If this is considered in the light most favorable, that he has worked under various complaints, and that the number has been submitted to these other particular employers, it says nothing about whether or not, it's simply not a valid inference that it belongs to somebody. It's simply not, it's not a valid inference. It might be, and at best, so in the light most favorable, it might be. It might belong, but we don't know because, and again, it gets back to Justice Price's question earlier about what's going on in the mind of Mr. Perez. That's what's important, and not speculating about, well, did he know? I don't know. But that's the thing you said about the inference drawn that he's worked in several places. Is it, maybe I'm suspicious, but that's not the obvious.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Hare, if I may, we see at 158 the prosecution making the argument in closing, I believe, that he just got lucky. Is that what you're supposed to believe? That's preposterous. Are you saying that when he goes on to say, do you mean to tell me not only did he get lucky, but he got nine digits that worked, but it just happened to be a woman in Broomfield, Colorado, et cetera, that he's arguing facts not in evidence? Is that what you're telling us? The record not support that statement in closing argument?
The inference is only as strong as it can be. That's to say that, A, it's not, it's actually, can you raise that inference? Yes, it's a possible inference. Is it true? It's unclear. It's not necessarily true that because the number worked, whatever that means, that it was going to be employment, that it belongs to something. As far as they're wrong, it makes that very clear. Justice Breyer acknowledges this man worked for 6 years, but it didn't belong to anybody. This Attorney General recognizes there are numbers that don't belong to anybody. If this is common knowledge, then that's one argument that can be made. But it's this is the evidence that sustains that they heard the outreach about. So that's my response, is that, is it invalid? No. The prosecution can refer to the prior instance and say he could use this, and but the notion that it worked, it cuts both ways. And so in the, even if it's in the likeness favorable for the prosecution, so they get the benefit of the 50-50, it can work in their advantage, but that's not what the government will have. That what's going on is this president, is that he knows he's using a number that belongs to somebody else. Because it's just not the first. The inference is not strong enough for the prosecution.
Thank you.
Some other points that the bill that Mr. Perez knew that the payroll system rejected or would reject social security number that did not belong to him or was not valid under that if it said it's not a real number that belonged to somebody. They didn't do that. And again, it gets back to what Mr. Perez knew at the time. And not so much what, in hindsight, what we can assume or speculate about what can or can't happen with regards to Social Security numbers. So when Mr. Perez goes in to apply for a job and he fills out an application and the number is accepted and they get the final opportunity for that's the best that we know. Whether or not he knows beyond reasonable doubt that he's using the number that belongs to another person is simply not.
Can I follow up on that argument just a minute? Can you give the mental state required for recklessness rather than knowledge? That is, that he just had to disregard a substantial risk that this belonged to someone else. Would you then say there was sufficient evidence?
Then I think it's a closer call, because then you just don't care. Your incentive is to get employment to work, so you're willing to take the risk that I don't know if it belongs to anybody or not. It may not. Maybe it'll never raise suspicion as it did in this case. It was worked two times.
And so is the thrust of your argument that for purposes of a motion for judgment of acquittal, sufficiency of the evidence, we make a distinction between recklessness and knowing?
it's certainly a worthwhile exercise because then one can distinguish between those who are seeking employment and in this particular industry, and really, they probably are more concerned about getting employment for their loved ones than they are about whether or not it belongs to somebody or it's figure-o. Again, if there's a perfect example of someone who is determined to work and they're going to use a number, on one occasion it doesn't belong to somebody, on another it does, but they are arguably reckless in regard to whether or not, in terms of whether they care about whether it is a real number or not. I have no further comments if the court has any other questions that we have to answer them. Otherwise, we'd ask the court to affirm the court of appeals.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hare.
Committing, I would like to make 6 points. First, it is a rule of construction that if the plain meaning of the language is clear and unambiguous, we do not resort to rules of construction. 18.1.503 is a rule of construction of statutes with regard to culpability. It is a rule of construction. Number two, this is not a plain meaning case. There's not clearly, it's plain language, only one possible interpretation. And the best guide to that is the defendant's argument, which relies on the rule of construction, the Court of Appeals argument, which position, which relies on third statutory rule of construction, and the Flores Figueroa case, which applied also the common law version of that same rule of construction. It recognized ordinarily when we have statutes, we apply the next rea across all. That was just the common law version of the same thing. It was not a simple question of English grammar. I've diagrammed this sentence. If somebody is an adverb, it applies to uses. I'm another. It's an adjective phrase modifying the object of that sentence, which is personally identifying. It's not plain language. And in fact, it was discussed before as Figueroa, the difference between statutes aren't written in the way that people normally talk.
Don't we say for purposes of jury instructions that every separately designated element that follows mens rea in an instruction, it can be presumed that the jury understood the mens rea to apply to all those?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is, again, the same presumption. For it to have been plain and ambiguous, clear and ambiguous for a Catholic instruction, dancing, it would have to say, no use personally identifying information, no it is of another. I agree with the presumption, but if you look at all of the other indications from the legislative intent, the intent was the contrary. They wanted to protect me. That's what this law was about. Number three, criminal impersonation 2011, it does cross-reference personal identifying information. It does not cross-reference of another. I think that that's significant, and that's at least the fair passage.
All right, thanks very much. Thanks, Mr. McReynolds, and thanks, Mr. Hare. We appreciate it. And we'll give you a little time to answer questions, and then the court will return shortly. All right, we're in recess.